Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast, everyone. It's April 10th, 2020, and I'm recording this around 5 o'clock today. So this is a little bit of what I call the happy hour podcast. I'm sure that means good chance of guest appearances by the kids as they're upstairs from the quote-unquote recording studio here. So I'm sure they'll make their way downstairs to check out whatever Daddy is doing. So there may be a guest appearance by one or both of the two. So I was going to play some music during this to give it the bar-like atmosphere, but then I figured some people might complain about having that in the background, so I decided to shut the Alexa down, and so we would not have anything coming from there. So anyway, the beer of the day that we've got here, we've got the Dogfish Head Slightly Mighty. This is their low-cal IPA. I've never tried this before. So I thought I would just give a shot to one of these to see how it is, since pretty much on a steady diet of cookies, I think, these days. We'll cut down a little on the alcohol intake to offset that. So we'll go down to the 95-calorie beer. Seems okay. You know, it's certainly pretty light, but that's what we're going for with the happy hour beer, I guess. So we'll try a couple of these here during the course of taping. So if you hear any jumps, that probably is me doing a pretty bad editing job when I'm running upstairs to grab another one out while we record here. So got a lot of good feedback, I think, on the surprise podcast that we did last week. I don't think a lot of people expected that to see that pop back up. And like I said, we'll try and do a couple of these here and there, and hopefully we can keep this under an hour, give or take a little bit. And again, if you have any feedback on topics that you're interested in hearing about, or just questions you want answered, or different kind of formats that you might be interested in us recording, you can let me know, and we'll try and do that. And if I can keep up with this, I will try and get a couple of the other guys on from OTC, or maybe some other people that want to hop on for an interview here and there, just to discuss some different things and have somebody else talking besides me all the time. So just to give you a different opinion, or maybe a little bit of a closer look at your favorite team. Unfortunately, today, the XFL sounds like they went out of business. They fired everybody involved with the XFL, except for a couple people, basically probably who are there to kind of, you know, close down the books officially. It was too bad. I thought the XFL was really innovative. I know the ratings had been declining week over week, but as a football product, I thought it was very good. I thought a lot of the things they did in terms of giving you access to the coaches, hearing some of the play calls, the way that the officials go over replays, I thought that was actually excellent. I thought that was a really, really cool thing. It was something completely different. I really enjoyed it. I like the style of play. I like the speed of it. Were the players great? No, there were a couple players who were pretty good in that league, and they stood out, and they're the couple who have gotten opportunities already in the NFL to try out this upcoming season, if there is a season. But it was kind of a shame to see that league kind of falter, really not because of anything that happened to them. I mean, this is a situation that you can't predict. Their financial model, I think, was based right now solely on the fact that they could sell tickets. They had a couple of places where the ticket sales were pretty strong. Seattle was really good. St. Louis was really good. The Texas teams, I think, did relatively okay. I think Tampa had done okay. New York was weak, and L.A. was weak. I think you kind of figured that going in. L.A., I think, had to be a given. I don't really know why they chose that market. I don't really even know why they chose the New York, New Jersey area. Now, I'm from here, and there's just too many other things. There's so many sports teams, and the quote-unquote B-level sports franchises here, whether it's the Nets, whether they've been playing in Brooklyn or New Jersey for so many years, the New Jersey Devils, who had a very successful run in hockey, you just can't break through. You know, it's very difficult. You know, the team is more successful than the Knicks, more successful for the most part than the Rangers, and the Rangers have had good years, obviously. There's just too many different sports, too many other things to expect people to become invested in those teams. And those were probably the two biggest mistakes they made. But I think to have the league closed down, that was obviously a big negative. And I think the other thing, and this was really the one worry that I had with the XFL, and we won't talk about the XFL for too long here, but the worry that I had with the XFL continuing, you knew they were going to lose money. They knew they were going to lose money. And I know they said they had enough cash that was earmarked for at least 2 years and probably three. I think the worry was that a lot of that was kind of funded on the fact that Vince McMahon had obviously a significant stake in his company, World Wrestling Entertainment. At the time when he started to fund the XFL, I'm going to say the stock was probably in the ballpark of $70 a share, give or take a little bit. It might have been a little bit higher when he sold off his $300 million to fund the league. That stock eventually hit a high point of close to $100 a share before it really started to tank. There were a lot of changes within that company. They fired their basically the people running the company on the business end of it, kind of out of nowhere, and that really sent them on a tailspin. They started on a way down their stock price. That immediately kind of wiped them out. And when they didn't really have a plan, it seemed like going forward beyond that, didn't really seem to have a good reason for why they fired them. The stock became pretty negative, and I'd say it probably dropped to about maybe $50 a share, which the kind of investment that McMahon has in that, that's a significant loss. So if on paper, if he's thinking the whole time while he's funding the XFL, that, you know, he has a stock in his pocket that's probably going to be anywhere from $70 to $100 million a share, you know, this becomes a drop in the bucket. When it drops down the way that it did, it becomes more difficult. And then it dropped down significantly more. You know, their business, just like everyone else's, has been hit significantly. Their stock right now is probably around $35 a share. Yeah, I would say it dropped as low as maybe 30, 31. So his personal wealth has certainly diminished greatly. He took out a loan on his stock a couple weeks ago, I think it was. We talked about getting liquid for, I don't know if it was for the WWE, if it was for himself, whatever it was. Those are all ominous signs, I think, that were probably there for anyone involved in the XFL. You know, to say that it's probably not coming back. And I would say the final nail in the coffin is the fact that with so much money being lost right now and there being so much economic uncertainty, and what I kind of mentioned last week when talking about the NFL with their upcoming TV negotiations and the deal for the players and the way the revenue splits and projections people are having, if you have a high unemployment rate, you're just not going to get that kind of money in advertising. There's just not that kind of money that's going to be there, I think, in some of those packages that they might expect from the television networks. So I would say that, you know, this probably may not bode well either for the NFL, at least in terms of looking forward. And I'm sure one of the things was that the thought process of the XFL was you were going to run one season or you were going to run two seasons. And in that time, you were going to do well enough on TV to garner a reasonable television contract. And I think they realized that that television contract was not going to be there given the state of affairs. And who knows, maybe they even got an indication that they were not going to cover television costs next year. The networks that he was partnering up with, the ABC family of networks and I think it was Fox was the other ones that had the broadcasts. You know, so it was, in my mind, a much better league than the AAF. It was much better run. It looked much better. It felt big league. It didn't feel like a minor league as much. The AAF completely felt like a minor league. It felt like fourth game of the preseason kind of football. The XFL, even in the stadiums that weren't drawing a lot of people, again, mainly the LA and New York ones, the games just never had that feel. I thought, like, I, you know, between the announcers and the camera work and the investments that were made by the networks into making it look like a professional, slick product, it was just really well done. And it's too bad to see it go. Some people, I'm sure, are going to be hopeful that it comes back. I would say it's highly unlikely. I think the circumstances are such that there's probably no chance that it returns. And it's unfortunate because it gives a lot of people an opportunity to work in some way, shape, or form in football, not just players, whether you're working as a scout, whether you're working as a coach, whether you're working in a front office. A lot of good people, I'm sure, were working in the league. I know there were a lot of good people working in the league, and it's a shame to see the circumstances be the reason that they're kind of out of a job right now. And unfortunately, we'll probably not have a have a return next season. So it's unfortunate, but, you know, it is unfortunately what it is. And maybe something else will pop up, but probably not in some time, because it's not as if the XFL was setting the world on fire. It was doing better than the AAF, but the AAF was dying a slow death. And I don't know if you'll get more money people to ever come in to be able to run a league, knowing that there's going to be those kind of losses, being willing to take those kind of losses, and try and put out there a competitive product the way that this league was done. So anyway, that was the news today that I didn't expect, but I just want to talk about it a little bit because I kind of enjoyed the league and enjoyed those games when they were being played. So the big news was the Rams traded Brandon Cooks to the Houston Texans. And, you know, it basically became yesterday, and I was part of it. Not going to say I wasn't. You know, it became pick on the Rams day. And that's the way these things happen, right? You know, things go well for a period of time, and you're at the top of the mountain. You know, everyone looked at McVay as like the next great genius in the NFL. You looked at the front office and said, wow, you know, everything they're doing is great. And then another year comes along and things don't look so good. And now you kind of start to pull back and you start to look at things, I think, a little bit more objectively sometimes. And you start to see, wow, you know, there's a lot of issues with the roster as constituted, and you have a lot of difficult decisions to make. This one was a tough one. All right. I said last week, if I didn't say it on here, I definitely said it on Twitter, but I may have said it here too. The amount of money that was going to be there for Brandon Cooks to trade him on the Rams salary cap was so high, $21.8 million in dead money. It's, I believe, the single largest cap hit ever taken for a player no longer on your team. There have been players who have had more dead money, but it's been split with a June 1. So, you know, Sue, I think, had more. Romo may have had more. I could look them up, but it's not that important. For a single year, I believe this is the highest. I think Antonio Brown was the highest after last year's debacle, where he was at 21.12 when he forced his way off the Steelers. And this one will be 21.8. And there's no recovering any money from that. You know, this is big. And so this is the Rams' second or third big cut, I guess, of the offseason. It's really the second big cut, but it's the third cut that actually is going to not just cost them salary cap space, but it's a cut that actually comes after they spent money on the players themselves. So the players in question here, they paid $4 million to Cooks before this one. Todd Gurley, who was cut a couple weeks ago, they paid him this year, let's see how much he's going to earn, 7.55 from them. There's an offset on that of, I think it's $2.5 million. So his deal is now official with the Falcons. So they will get a 2.55 credit or a 2.5 credit, whatever the number is, on that. So basically they're going to pay him $5 million this year. And the other one was Clay Matthews. And he had a guarantee, I'm going to say of two, but let me just look up. Yeah, guarantee of $2 million. So he's going to be paid $2 million to leave the team. And I'm sure there's probably some offset there if he signs somewhere. He'd probably be looking at a minimum deal, which is about $1 million. So maybe they'll get a $1 million offset on that if he signs elsewhere. So the question you ask yourself is, well, what happened? You know, what caused this? You know, where what happened that this just blew up? And yeah, there's a couple of different ways that we can look at this. So first, let's just look at the mistakes, if you want to call them mistakes, that were made. And I think really when you go back and you really look at it and you get through all the initial, you know, picking on the team or just, you know, having fun at their expense. You know, what was the old Bugs Bunny cartoons or something? You know, they'd have the picture of like Elmer Fudd or something like that. You know, then they'd morph into the jackass. You know, that's their day in the sun. You get the one day with that. So where did things go wrong? So the first one that's really wrong, it was Gurley. the reason that you say Gurley is the one that really stands out, and let's just pull up his numbers here. The reason he stands out is this is the kind of contract that you do with a player where, and I talk about it as, you know, you kind of, you put your neck on the, in the noose. You're really going on the line when you sign a player like that. Why? What has history told us about running backs for years? This isn't getting into things where people will debate the usefulness of something like a WAR statistic from Pro Football Focus or a Pro Football Focus grade or you know, different kind of valuations. You know, evaluation maybe that I'll put on OTC or Football Outsiders where they may have you know, DVOA or something like that. It's not about that. It's not even that. What are you looking at when it comes to running backs? You're just looking at things that drive a contract. What drives a contract? Most of the time, it's volume. A lot of it has to do with volume statistics and efficiency within that volume. But in general, if a player runs for a lot of yards, carries the ball a lot of times, catches a lot of passes, you know, he's going to be one of the higher compensated players in the NFL. So let's just pull up Gurley's stats. I should have had these pulled up before, but let's just pull them up real quick. Let's just see where he was in 2017. 2017, you know, you're talking about a Pro Bowler, all-pro player. 279 carries, 1,300 yards, 13 touchdowns, 87 targets on the year, 788 yards, 6 receiving touchdowns. That's from Pro Football Reference. Those should be official statistics. I think it was in 2017 when he was the Offensive Player of the Year. Let's see. I can look that up. Yeah, he was the Offensive Player of the Year in 2017. I think he was considered the driver of that offense. He was basically there to, you know, help Goff, I guess, out in that development, take some of the pressure off. The problem is, and this is just the thing with any running back, this is what we get to. Well, what happens to those running backs? We don't need to get into all the other crazy stuff with them at all. All we have to look at is your general production that happens with running backs for years, pretty much after they get into that fifth or sixth season into their career, which is just right beyond the rookie deals. Well, what happens? You start to find their play time diminishes a lot. Why? Because they're not available. Maybe they're missing games. If they're not missing games, they're banged up and they're not giving you as many snaps as they used to in a game. Their numbers are plummeting. Their numbers are going way down. You're seeing their yards per attempt fall. Why does that happen? Well, in some cases, it's because, you know, the offensive line isn't doing as good. Or, you know, maybe your season isn't going as well. And a lot of the you know, the play of the running back is, you know, associated with the game script that's going on. Either way, whatever it is, those numbers are diminishing. It's diminishing returns every year at those positions. And we've got years and years and years of just basic numbers just to look at. Easy stuff to understand. Now, his ended up being worse off because he basically has bum knees. It sounds like it's a degenerative condition in there with arthritis or whatever. That was something that they probably were more privy to than anybody else. I'm sure that they had to have some type of medical evaluation that would have said, hey, you know, he might be a little bit more on borrowed time even than other players. Why do you do a deal like that? And there's different reasons that you can probably, you know, that you can probably make for doing some type of contract. But the fact is, at the time, the old style deals had gotten too many teams in trouble. So they had all moved away from this. The only teams really that had any kind of legitimate long-term deal, there were some short-term things from Marshawn Lynch and stuff like that that were a little bit higher. But really, I think you're going back to Adrian Peterson and Chris Johnson in 2012. I think they signed their big deals. So you're basically going from 2011 was Minnesota. So you're going from 2011 all the way to 2018, where there's basically no contract signed by a running back that fit into this stratosphere, that fit into this. You know, $22 million fully guaranteed at signing, $45 million guaranteed for injury. The effective guarantee, I would have pegged this at probably about $49 million. It didn't end up there because they cut ties way sooner than I anticipated because things happened to be that bad. You know, you chalk this one up as a loser. That's just what you do. Every now and then a team is going to make mistakes. We talked about that about Philadelphia last week with Jeffrey. You're going to make mistakes. What happened? Well, you try and chalk it up and say, well, this will be our last mistake. You just hope that's the case. But that's what happened. This was a contract where the logic behind it probably is the fact that you go back to 2017, you look at where they were with their salary cap. They had a good salary cap situation, you know, at the time. And I think you look at where they wanted to be. They're a young team. They're an ascending team. They're moving, you know, forward. And obviously they make the Super Bowl the following year. And I think you look at this as like, you know what? We're going to do good by one of our players. And we're going to show everybody on the team, you know, that we're going to do good by our guys. You know, we don't need this to get into a big long holdout or anything like that. While that was sort of going on with Aaron Donald at the same time, there's a difference in cost between the two. Signing Todd Gurley to a $14.4 million deal gives you that flexibility to still, within the year, be able to sign other players to extensions, or to have been able to sign players earlier, in the season in free agency. You have more financial flexibility with that than when you're talking about someone who's looking to make $22 million a year. You know, again, there's a time and a place. Every team operates within a budget. It's how you allocate the budget each year, you know, to work, not just from a salary cap sense, just from a real dollars and cents aspect. You know, what is somebody working with? So I think the decision was this was the way to go to show, you know, to show everybody that, you know, this is how we're going to do this, and this is the right way to do it. In terms of structure, you know, it was just a difficult. It was a risky play. And they just couldn't escape it. You know, they're going to ultimately carry, $8.4 million dead for him next year. You know, that'll be offset by whatever is gained. So it'll be a net of about $6 million, $5.9 million, I guess. And this year they're going to end up carrying, about $11.75 million, I think, for him dead. So it's a huge money loser for them. What was your alternative? The alternative, which was probably the right way to do it, even if it's going to upset people, is you make him play it out. And in his case, you know, he was under contract in 2018 for 2.4, and he was under contract in 2019 for 9.6. And as things turned out, he ended up earning 23 in 2018 and about 9.6 in 2019. I guess that one ended up staying the same. Let me make sure I'm at the right spots here. Yeah, they kept the cash the same there. So basically it was a giant raise for the first year. And then he's got that guarantee that kicked in on the 7.55. So, you know, this is just a warning. This is a warning to the Carolina Panthers. This is the warning to the New York Giants. Don't think, well, it's not going to happen to my guy. You know what? Maybe there is that 1 in 100 it's not going to happen to. You know, Adrian Peterson was pretty effective for a good chunk of his contract. He was the 1 in 100. You know, LeSean McCoy maybe was another one who was pretty effective for most of his contract. Most of the other guys, you know, someone like an Arian Foster was really effective when he played. When did he play? Other guys just aren't effective. You know, Devonta Freeman was just a dud from the minute pen went to paper. It was just all downhill. Always hurt, never performing well, he's cut. Just so many examples historically. You just don't do it. This is not the kind of player, it's not the position that you take a risk in. And they just decided to. How much of that comes from the draft, you know, that's probably part of it as well. Teams, sometimes you get a little overly invested sometimes in your draft picks. Remember, there was a lot of controversy when they took Gurley with the 10th overall pick. Why? Because the option year was going to be higher. I think that was the first year there was a running back that was taken, I'm not going to say in the first round in a couple of years, but certainly I think in the top 10, I think that was the first. And I think that's what opened the gates for the Fournettes and the Ezekiel Elliotts to get drafted in the first round. But there was a lot of questioning just when that was done as a draft pick, you know, top 10 pick. You know, why couldn't they trade back to get him at 11, you know, for example? Was there a way they could move one slot back? just take him at 11. Maybe that was worth it. Yeah, and sometimes that goes into your decision-making, I'm sure, as well. You know, you believe strongly in the guy. He plays well as a rookie. He plays well in the third year of the deal. And you think it's all there. And, you know, you take that shot at it. Now, here's the one thing I'll say. If you're going to extend a running back, that's the year to do it. And the reason that I say that is because, effectively, of his guarantee package, you know, if you look back on his old contract, that 9.6 and the 2.3, so we'll call it $10 million. $10 million was already guaranteed. The way that, for whatever reason, agents negotiate guarantees has nothing to do with the quote-unquote new guarantee. So you kind of, you take something out of it. It gives you a way to kind of mitigate the salary cap risks in the deal. The problem with this one was just that there was just too much money guaranteed early in the contract, the way that these guarantees kicked in that were injury guarantees. You know, if they did a full guarantee of $21.95, you know, what it stated up front, if they did that full guarantee of 22 and they didn't have anything kick in this year until, excuse me, until the beginning of the season, you know, third day of the league year, that's when all his guarantees kicked in, it wouldn't be as bad. You know, okay, you gave him a $10 million raise, didn't work out too well. Okay, it wasn't, not the end of the world. And maybe there was a better way things could have been structured then at that point. To me, that's the big mistake. Excuse me. Of all the moves, that's the big one. The next one that you have coming up is Brandon Cooks. Now, is Brandon Cooks a mistake? And here's where we get into, again, multiple ways to look at things. The Gurley contract was a complete leap of faith. All right? We're talking about taking years and years and years and years and years of data and saying, don't do it. That's screaming in our face, don't do it. What are you doing? Don't do it. On top of that, we have years and years and years and years and years of market data that says, not only don't do it, you don't have to do it. There is no team that's out there right now that's going to pay that. You can't find a comparable. Now, notice, once Gurley's deal was signed, well, David Johnson quickly fell in place, Elliott quickly fell in place, a couple of the bigger deals, Le'Veon Bell, those players could not get a deal until there was at least something else done to convince other teams, okay, it's all right. So there was no reason for it, just because there was no priors on that. When we get into Brandon Cooks plays a position where there are priors. Now, I pick on the Brandon Cooks deal nowhere near as much as I pick on the Sammy Watkins deal. But at the time it was signed, it was like, wow, they're going to 16 for Brandon Cooks. The market in my mind on someone like Brandon Cooks is probably 14. But that's not really where the market had gone. The market changed for wide receivers, I think, when Alshon Jeffrey got that deal from Philadelphia. What's the year on that one? That was 2017. So that was the 1 year before that. They did the deal for $13 million a season. Alshon Jeffrey was not a $13 million a year player. Alshon Jeffrey was a market mover, in my mind, based just on that contract alone. And that kind of set the stage for a whole bunch of deals to come down that might have not been what people would be, you know, would consider ideal. So, again, where you get into, you know, talking hardball with players in a contract negotiation. But, you know, what do we have? Well, what happened then in 2018? Well, we had Sammy Watkins go for 16. How can you justify? All right. He signs on March 14th. Brandon Cook signed on, let's see what his date is. Let me make sure I have the timeline right. He signs in July. All right, July 19th, 2018. Yeah, it might have been a couple days before. It might have been a couple days after. But that's when it was. If Sammy Watkins is signing for 16, and Sammy Watkins' claim to fame is that he's a first-round draft pick, because statistically, where they were at the time, you probably couldn't compare the two. They're both first-round talents. Watkins was picked higher. But they're both first-round talents. And if he's at 16... can you justify Cooks at anything less than that? And that's the question that you have to ask, because if you make Cooks an offer, if you're looking to extend him for whatever reasons that you're doing it, all right, he was set to earn, where was his Rams deal? He was set to earn $8.5 million when they traded for him. They ended up paying him, a lot more. We'll get into that in a second. But they ended up, dropping his cap charge by a couple million. They probably didn't need to do it that year. I don't remember off the top of my head. I wouldn't think so at that point in time. But, that was where the market had gone. You know, Jarvis Landry, who was a possession kind of guy, he went for 15 that offseason. Diggs went for 14.4. When was Diggs' deal signed? Diggs was signed in... He was signed a little bit later in July. So they worked actually probably off that deal a bit, from the Cooks contract. And, there's a big difference. There's a difference, regardless of what people want to say with a lot of these, the players, unless you are just a complete blowaway talent, there's a lot of status that's really put in where you were drafted. You're looking at a fifth rounder, I think, for Diggs. Versus a first rounder for Brandon Cooks. Plus, you traded for him and all that other jazz. But the market, in my mind, had changed. Allen Robinson gets 14 coming off injury. It's one of those deals where I think, from a price perspective, I don't think you can argue with it. You can argue with the market. And you can argue that you have to be sometimes stricter with that. But once you made that trade for somebody, you've pretty much already given in that you consider him, a top-line player. Let me just see where his numbers were when he signed his deal. Now, remember, he's coming off playing, with the Patriots. So, he's playing with the top-line quarterbacks here. So anyway, let's look at the numbers here. He comes off a season where he's averaging, really, it's in the 3 years. So you've got him playing with Breeze and Brady, 1138, 1173, 1082, 9.8, and 7 touchdowns. I mean, those are numbers that people pay for. Now, you can argue, again, the efficiency of some of those numbers, but that's what people are going to pay for. His first season with the Rams, 1,200 yards, 5 touchdowns, you're probably not disappointed in that. At the time, I argued that Brandon Cooks was going to have to be a better player, I think, to justify the contract. And I think that that's probably accurate. Let me see if I can pull up my old article here. Let's see if I can dig up the old one. Here we go. Let's see what I wrote. This was written... right after I finally got the details on it. So when you looked at him compared to the big name players, these are the issues that I had. Cook ranked ahead of only Watkins in percentage of team targets, team receptions, and team receiving yards. So, and he was last in percentage of team touchdowns. So here's where I'm going a little bit off the general, the overall statistical numbers. And what I'm going for based on that is, okay, you can put up hyper numbers because you happen to be in a hyper offense, the Patriots and more specifically the Saints. Now, the Rams envision themselves, I think, being that kind of team. You've got a young quarterback with a lot of upside. You're building this team that you think is kind of going to be this high-flying, aerial act. This is going to be your guy that pushes the ball down the field. This is going to be your guy that gets open down the field to catch the big bombs, make the big plays, which are very important. The reason that I bring up these percentage of team numbers here, when I compared him to other receivers that were in the same salary range, is just the fact that I thought that his numbers were probably a little bit more of a byproduct of the system than they necessarily were of the player. Some of these other players are demanding such a high target share, and they're equating for so much of a team's offense, that they're true number one players. So in this, I said, you probably would look at Cooks as a 1A. Here was just the comparable players at the time that were there. Percentage of their team's targets in the last, I don't know if this was the last year or 2 years. Antonio Brown was nearly was just over 29%. Mike Evans was at 26. Hopkins was at 28.5. Watkins was 12.3. Jarvis Landry was 27.1. And Devontae Adams was 20.1. And Brandon Cooks was at 18.3. So there's a difference. There's just a difference in that. But the way the wide receiver market had gone, you just had this bunch of players where you had these great players like Hopkins and Evans. And I know people will say Evans is a real boom or bust type, but, you know, Hopkins and Evans and, you know, a couple other guys, you know, Beckham eventually, that all kind of got squished together because of one or two contract decisions, some of which, you know, I may have heard some things about that people didn't necessarily agree with my takes on them, which is okay. That's normal. These are just opinions. But it caused this, like, this big logjam. Same thing that happened with quarterbacks, right? So you had this big logjam. So there's no way that you can really get a Cooks deal done at a lesser number. But I think you have to question, did he belong there in the first place? Once you make that trade, you're saying, well, you know, screw these numbers that I'm talking about here. We believe he's going to do it. He's going to take that next step to where two things are going to happen. Either we're going to be driving the ball so much that his efficiency numbers don't have to be so high because, like in New Orleans, we're just going to throw the ball all over the field and he's going to get his 1,200 yards, 1,100 yards, and everyone is going to be happy. Or he's going to have to raise his level of game to where he's demanding more targets because he's becoming maybe more of a complete player. Maybe he's going to be open more. Maybe whatever it is. You know, the questions that I had here, I'm just reading through this for the, I posted this yesterday real quick just to answer someone, but I didn't really read it over. So my feeling for the Rams to get out of the value out of this contract, they need a couple things to happen. One is that Cooks maintains his ability to stretch your field. I think that can be hit or miss. DeSean Jackson kept it up for his career. Other players can't. If he can't, you know, does he have the ability to reinvent himself as a possession type receiver? And we see that sometimes. You'll have these guys that were dominant, you know, down the field kind of threats, and then they kind of change their game completely. You know, similar to where Michael Jordan went from being the dunk man when he was younger to developing like that great mid-range game, which at the time in the NBA was really where things were at, and that kind of made him unstoppable, even as he lost the ability to, you know, jump as high as he used to. You know, and the second thing that I had is, are the Rams going to have to run a more open offense? You know, if Watkins' failure was a byproduct of the offense rather than the player, you know, it's not a good sign. And, you know, remember Watkins played on the Rams the year before. So it seems like they had something in mind that they were going for here. You know, they traded for Watkins. That was a good trade because it's a high upside player. You take a shot at him. And I think they had this thought that Watkins is going to stretch the field. Didn't happen. Watkins wasn't any good. So now you say, well, Cook's going to stretch the field. And again, this is our replacement for Watkins. We're going to pay him more. So I think you can justify that, you know, that. So, you know, that was my take at the time, and I think I stick with that. Now, the issue that you have here, as you get to it, is the structure of the deal. You know, did they have to do this structure? Yes, there were some crazy rules in place that dealt with 30% rules and all that kind of crazy talk, where you had to do certain things. The question is, did they have to structure it the way they did? And what are we talking about here? And the big question mark here is this second year, $28 million payment in the second year of the contract, a $17 million option bonus. I mean, that is huge. That brings his prorated total on that deal up to $24 million. You know, at the time, let's just jump into these again. Here's where we're going on our cash flows on the contract. And you know, I could probably pull up some more advanced stuff too, but I'll just go with the stuff, the market at the time. So Brandon Cooks in his extension year did not get much of a raise. So that was solid for the Rams. However, by year one, his take home in the first new year of the deal, well, that beats out Antonio Brown. It beats out Mike Evans. It beats out DeAndre Hopkins. It crushes Sammy Watkins and Jarvis Landry and Devontae Adams because the new money total was $30 million. Now, again, you can argue the differences where we're talking new money versus existing money. And I can understand that completely in this case from the Rams' point of view because they traded for him. They really have no obligation to that old contract. So in their mind, this is probably more of $38 million through the second year of the deal. And this is where things get a little complicated, because there's really two ways of looking at the deal. There's a team way of looking at it, where people will talk about that effective annual value or paper annual value. And then there's the way that the agents look at it. And most of the time with these extensions, everything is negotiated in terms of new money. So that's how I have them valued here. In this case, I think because of the trade, you definitely can make an exception for the team, that you want to look at the cash flow structure of this more as an overall thing. So in his case, you know, that would have been, going back here, you would have looked at $11 million in the first year, and you would have looked at $38 million by the second year. And $38 million by the second year, you know, that puts him under the class of the Hopkins, Evans, Brown class. So there is a justification that you can have from the Rams' perspective of saying, you know, it's not as bad as I'm saying. But the numbers, you know, clearly from the agent side, they're negotiating this on the new money numbers, because you can just see how they line up. And, you know, you get to the second year, new money, $42 million is bigger than Brown. It's less than Brown, but it's still bigger than Evans. It's bigger than Hopkins. You get to year three, and it's the 54s. You know, he's now tied with Evans, and he's below Brown. He's still above Hopkins. Now, I think here is where you kind of get into that category of, all right, we went all in on this. Should we have gone to this kind of length to where we needed to push this kind of money up front? Or should we have tried to find a little bit more of a common ground to where we do the deal more like the Chiefs did with Sammy Watkins, 3-year deal, where the Bears went with Allen Robinson, 3-year deal? Should we have looked more at something like that? It gives the Rams 4 effective years, would have brought the money way down, in my opinion. You know, from where it was, APY would have stayed the same. Your average annual value still is going to stay 16, but your structure is going to be different. You're not going to pony up as much money necessarily up front. You're not going to have this monster signing bonus, this monster option bonus in the deal. You're going to be able to structure it a little bit more in a way that's probably advantageous for you. You know, the negative of a deal like that is if the player succeeds, you get no benefit on the back end, because he's going to be eligible for another contract. You know, the Bears with Robinson, who's been pretty good, obviously, there, they're not going to benefit from a back end on that, because he's going to look for a deal that moves him from that $14 million range that he's at now, you know, into the 16-17s. So you don't get that back end, you know, benefit. That's the risk. So that's a little bit of a trade-off. You know, it's again a risky kind of decision, but I think if you envision yourself the type of offense that was being run maybe in some of these other places he was playing, I think you can see the logic in it, you know, that you do that deal. Again, I think the questions that you have are the structure, the years. Was there a different path to making this happen? And there may have been. And there may have been a little bit of a path that would have made this better. Now, people are going to get on them for paying a $4 million roster bonus. The roster bonus was guaranteed. All right. Was there an offset on it? I don't even know. I don't care. It doesn't matter, because if they try to move him before that, they're not going to trade him. To get a second round pick back for a player, that's good. If you had to pay $4 million for a second round pick, so be it. You paid an extra $4 million. You got a second round pick. Hey, that's better than paying $16 million for a second round pick. And everyone was throwing balloons and having a party when that's what the Browns got for Osweiler. So $4 million, that's nothing. Drop in the bucket. Don't worry about that aspect of it. You know, I think you just go back to the structure of the deal. The other decisions, I think, then that you start to look at with the team, I think you just want to start to kind of look at certain things that they were doing. Now, the move that probably gets the most criticism for them, other than the Gurley one, is actually probably the Jared Goff signing. And that one's always been surprising to me. You know, I say this all the time on Twitter. I say it all the time here. It's a quarterback. It's like you just throw everything out when you're dealing with a quarterback. There was nothing that Goff did that is so bad in his career. Jared Goff was not Mark Sanchez, okay? He wasn't. He was not Mark Sanchez. He wasn't Tim Couch. You know, it's not like this was a guy who couldn't play football and you gave him a big extension. Jared Goff was, you know, as good as Matt Stafford was, probably when Stafford was younger. Stafford got a big deal. Anyone really complain? No. For whatever reason, there's something that sets people off about Goff. Is it that maybe they don't see an upside there? You know, has he had that stretch of games that would be similar to Carson Wentz? You know, Carson Wentz had that stretch of games before he got hurt where he looked like a legitimate MVP candidate. Did he have that kind of stretch? No, he probably didn't. Who cares? That's not the way the quarterback position goes. There's a reason why Nick Foles gets 20-something million dollars a year from the Jacksonville Jaguars. Nobody is complaining that Teddy Bridgewater is getting $23 million. Teddy Bridgewater has played 5 games in like 4 years. Did anyone complain when Jimmy Garoppolo got $28 million when he played 3 games with the New England Patriots? Whatever it is. Maybe I complain. But most people didn't. They looked at it, oh, that's a great deal. You know, because the 49ers front-loaded a bunch of cap dollars in the deal, whereas the Rams did something very similar. They just happened to do it in the second year, this year, not the first. Unless you are going to play the musical quarterback game, and I talk about that. I like it. I like the concept of it. I like the idea of constantly drafting quarterbacks. I think it makes sense. There's nothing wrong with paying Jared Goff what they're paying him. He's not the problem. The problem was also not restructuring him. That was crazy. When people say restructure, why would you want to restructure his deal? Look, there's two paths this can take, right? What can happen with Jared Goff? Jared Goff becomes great. Okay, maybe it happens. By taking a $36 million cap hit this year, he becomes much more manageable down the line. What are his numbers? 32, 5, 35, 30, and 26. There might be some escalators in there. I don't remember. His numbers become much more manageable as you go year by year by year. They just do. So that's number one. Number two, let's say he stinks. Let's say if for whatever reason, and we've seen this happen too, you know, guys that maybe the pressure gets to him too much and they never live up to that potential. They never hit that ceiling. Maybe Goff is going to be that guy, you know, and things start to regress. Things go backwards. Well, the last thing that you want to do is push more money into this contract to where, you know, you have a day where instead of in 2022 or something like that, you know, that you can cut him for $10 million on the cap, that you're looking at $30 million cap charge, because that's what you're asking by having them, you know, push that money. That one's not really a mistake. That one is, you're just doing it. You're trying to get a deal in before the money goes even more crazy. He comes in after Wentz. He has the first round. He's number one overall pick. Same agent. This is the way it's going to work. All right. There's nothing wrong with it. Jalen Ramsey is the one I think you have to have a big question about. The Rams probably played well enough to make the playoffs. They just didn't get a couple good breaks, I think, on the ball for the season. It also didn't help that they played in a very difficult division. You know, if they played in the NFC East, they probably would have made the playoffs. If they played in the NFC South, they probably had a chance that they would have won an extra game or two to have been a wild card. Maybe that even would have happened in the NFC North. The NFC West was a little bit more difficult. I think that hurt them. Trading away the two first-round picks and only getting, I think it's a fourth back for Marcus Peters, I think that's just a decision that was very, it was probably too short-sighted. I don't think that you were looking at a Super Bowl team last year. I think maybe they should have known that at the time. That's giving away a lot for the future. It really is. Now, you're getting a second-round pick back by moving Cooks out. So that replenishes somewhat. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you look at the book that we just did, the drafting stage, and you just look at some other things. Look, a first-round pick has more value than a second-round pick. It does. The drop-off from first to second round is not gigantic. You know, people want to make it seem as if the first-round pick is absolute solid gold. It's not. There are areas of the first round where the second round is just as good, if not better. You know, or you found more hits there. It is always better if you have a late first round pick. It's probably always better to move into the top of the second round. You know, unless you value that last option year so much, it's probably better for you to do that. So they did get something back at least on the Cooks thing. The Ramsey thing, I think, is a mistake. I think that's the kind of move that sets you back, because they're also in a position where they're going to have to give him a mega contract, I think, because you made that trade for him. You know, the money is going to be there. He's going to want to be the top paid at the position, and you're going to have to do it. The other one that I really wasn't crazy about, I know people will disagree with me, I wasn't crazy about bringing back Michael Brockers. The price they got him at is very reasonable. If you look at what his deal was going to be with the Rams, I'm sorry, with the Ravens before that deal fell through, and you see what the Rams got him for, it's an incredibly affordable contract for the Rams. That was one where I'm going to guess, because of the timing of when the Ravens deal fell apart and how familiar he was with the Rams organization, it pushed him there, because there was probably spots that may have paid him more than that, I think. Than what he got there. I just thought, based on the way that they've kind of deconstructed their defense to, I think, change system around and, bring in players that aren't going to be the Wade Phillips defense. And I know he's a versatile player and everything. I think after you made the investment in Robinson from Detroit, I almost just thought this was a little bit of an overkill. And it's like, if you're trying to clean up your roster a little bit, sometimes at that point, I don't think you want to reach into the past, to bring somebody else back, unless it's dirt cheap. And maybe there's a feeling that this is cheap enough to where, hey, it's dirt cheap. I mean, his cap hit this year is like 3.8. And even if it's just for the 1 year, I don't believe he's too expensive to cut. There's some nice banging going on from the kids, so I'm sure they may be on their way down here soon. His dead next year would be 4.6, about $5 million dead. But there would be probably an offset on that, on a portion of a salary guarantee. You could look at that either way. Now, the other thing is where people will get on them for saying, wow, they're really killing themselves. And this is where I'm probably going to be of a different opinion than a lot of other people, I think, at least. Here's the way that you have to look at this. Are the Rams worse right now without Todd Gurley than they were with Todd Gurley? How many wins was Todd Gurley going to change for them? The answer is probably zero. All right. There wasn't much they were going to get out of him. How many wins was Brandon Cooks going to equal? Again, it's probably not many. If these are players where the whole offseason, the fan base, the general people talking about the Rams, were talking about how bad these contracts were, how bad these players were, how they weren't going to justify these deals. Cooks and concussions and Gurley in the knee, and just they're not good enough. They were overpaid, overhyped, over this, over that, over whatever. Now you cut them and you've got all this dead money from them, and you go, boy, what are the Rams doing? Well, here is really what you have to look at with them. And you look at Cooks. What do they save by trading Cooks? They save $8 million this year. They had to pay him $8 million. Look, the rest of the dead money was going to be the same. You open up an extra $8 million in cap room that you're rolling over into 2021 by cutting him now versus waiting until 2021 to make the same move. And by doing it now, you're getting a second round pick. It's a second round pick that you can use this year in a somewhat deep draft, from what people say. So you're getting that now. You're getting that reward now. You're getting the cap dollars that you can use next year to, to extend your players or to sign free agents, whatever it is. If you had this money budgeted, well, now you're putting it off. That's also cash that you're saving that you can use on other players next year. So in my mind, Brandon Cooks in return for a number two and $8 million, hey, that's a good trade for them. It makes more sense than the alternative. Gurley, what do you gain by keeping Gurley? All right. So here is what it would have cost them had they kept Todd Gurley this year. They would have had to pay him an extra $5.5 million in salary this year. Plus, he would have had another $5 million that became guaranteed. So you were looking at an extra $10.5 million there. There's the 2.5 in offsets. So, he happened to get that money this year. I can guarantee you next year, he is not getting, if there's an offset on that roster bonus, which there probably is, he's not getting 2.5. He's not getting 5.5. He's not getting 1.5. He's probably getting 1. You know, if a team owes him 5, especially if there was no offset, he's getting 1. You know, I'm sorry, if there is an offset, he's getting 1. So realistically, I think you would look at this and you would say that you are gaining anywhere from 12 to 13 million in cap space by releasing Gurley this year. So when you look at the big picture of it, you are saving a significant amount of money that would have really hurt you next year. So if you look at the Rams' projected cap space, where we have them right now, and we might be short on a player or two, you know, and obviously they're going to look to extend Ramsey. Let me just pull up their numbers here. And they're going to have to make some changes because I don't think they have the cap room actually to do the trade, at least once they finalize the Robinson deal. But you look at where they are with their, I'll do their effective cap space, which takes into account their minimums. You know, about $50 million in cap room next year. And now that, again, that's before certain deals are done. but about $50 million. Now, is that great? No, that's still probably, that's around the midway point in the NFL for next season. And, you know, you get a deal done with Ramsey, they're going to drop even further. But they have other deals on their team that they can modify or that they're going to release, they're going to get rid of. So I look at this very similar to what I talked about with Minnesota last week. It's almost like you're one of those organizations that, okay, let's say the Ramsey thing was very short-sighted. This is the year where you take that step back, you objectively evaluate the roster, whether you have somebody else giving you input on it that you've brought in from the outside, whether you're just listening to other people's, other voices, just in the media in general, overviews of the team, or you huddle up as a front office and you take a look at the big picture and you say, what are the odds that we can compete for a championship with this roster? Do we need Todd Gurley and Brandon Cooks to compete for a championship? And the answer for that is no, you don't, when you look at the alternatives in terms of the finances, because your options are basically doubling down on some of these deals and buying further and further into 2021 and possibly 2022. Or you say, you know what? It's kind of a soft rebuild. We're going to take a couple guys, get them out, bring a couple new faces in, and we're going to try and load up and load up and load up to where in 2022 we can, you know, kind of change this around again. And you're not forfeiting a season. You're not going down that rabbit hole that the New York Jets started to go down in the early 2000s that they never recovered from. You're not going down the rabbit hole that the Detroit Lions went down for years with the couple of those big contracts. You're not going down the rabbit hole of the Carolina Panthers. You're not going down the rabbit hole of the New Orleans Saints, who had to go through three seasons in a row, I think, of, you know, being a 7-win team. You're avoiding that. You really are. You're avoiding that rabbit hole by not doubling and tripling down on a bunch of contracts to take a shot with a roster that probably was not going to get it done. So it's the right moves for them. It just doesn't look good. You know, it's a tough look. And I think as an organization, what do? Well, you go back and you evaluate those deals, the kind of things I was talking about there. And you say to yourself, okay, where did we go wrong with them? And how would we handle them if they came up again? And I think that's where you get into the different options that you would do, you know, where you start to consider, all right, well, what happens if we go the route of playing a contract out? You know, how much damage is that going to do in our locker room? How much complaining is there going to be? Is there going to be a holdout? Or is the agent going to be in the media complaining and complaining and complaining that a deal is not getting done? You know, what happens if, you know, we only do a shorter term deal? You know, what's the impact of doing the short-term versus a long-term deal, you know, paying more now for the possible benefits later on? And you just evaluate all those things. But in terms of a big picture, these are the right moves. The Rams are no worse off today than they were March 1st. They're no worse off. If anything, they're probably better off. It just doesn't look good. So I think that's kind of the way that I would look at the Rams here. It's actually gone on a lot longer than I thought, so I'm already an hour in on this. So I'll hold off, and maybe we'll do another one this week or early on or something. I'll do a couple questions that I got, but I know I had I think it was Reese that asked about thoughts on the CBA. That probably should be a whole little topic unto itself. So maybe I'll just do a CBA one. But let me just take a look. I know I didn't get a lot of questions because I just randomly tweeted out some stuff on there. So let's see what questions that I got here. See, I spelled the Rams wrong. That was wonderful. Okay, let's see. Quick stuff here. Mike Sims, GM's role involves scouting and cap management. Who are the best, worst GMs at managing both roles? Or do they outsource all the latter to experts? I think there's certain general managers who take a pretty hands-on approach with everything, but I think most general managers trust and work with, all the people within their front office. You know, it's a tricky thing to kind of, find ways to merge your scouts with the cap department and, your general manager kind of as the coach. You know, if you want to look at the however you want to look at them, if you want to look at your scouts as kind of your offensive coordinator, your cap guys, maybe as your defensive coordinator, and your GM as a head coach, and you've got all these different assistants. I think the ones who I think are competent in all aspects of it are the ones who are really good with it. If you ask me who are the ones that I look at and say, well, I think that they try and utilize as many tools as possible when it comes to it. I would put I'm just looking at my site and I'm just going in the order that we have them pegged up top. I'd put a team like the Bills in there, even though I don't think I think the Bills get a little bit too much praise as to where they are. And they may be really good, but it's the one wild card year. You throw out the one from that first year with Tyrod Taylor. I think they're an in-tune organization to what they do. The Patriots, obviously, the Ravens are very good, I think, when it comes to that. The Colts might be, to some extent. I think Kansas City is probably pretty cohesive. San Francisco is very cohesive. The Rams are pretty cohesive. Seattle, I think, is pretty cohesive, even though you may argue against what they do. And same with the Rams, you may argue against with what they do. I think it's a pretty cohesive group, the way that it all works. I think Oakland has actually gone in that direction as well. Tampa is probably there. Minnesota is definitely there. Philadelphia. Maybe the Packers, maybe. I don't have as much of a feel on them yet. I think those are the organizations that I just look at and say, it does seem to all work together cohesively in some way, shape, or form. Yeah, Pittsburgh, that's another one too. The teams that don't, Houston comes across as islands. That there's differences of things, and they remind you of that old style where the coach just says, "Get her done." And, the deals just get done for whatever with little thought that probably goes into it. I think there's a disconnect between, what a scout or what a cap person should be able to tell you what should you get as a return for Jadeveon Clowney, especially if you're paying him $7 million to go away. There's just a complete disconnect, I think, with that kind of stuff. The Jets have been disconnected for years. I won't say that that's the case now. They have a new general manager, so we don't know. But for years, the Jets were the Browns, obviously. They have pulled in 8 million directions. Again, new regime, who knows? So, when you talk on the negative side, it's kind of harder because you're looking at teams that have, don't have, a long history. The Jaguars, they're just no. The Giants, I think that's very much, Gettleman has his view of things, and it's just, cap guys do whatever, these guys do whatever. Washington, I think, is that way. Atlanta, they're kind of an interesting one that way. The Saints are a get-it-done kind of team, and I think they work very well in terms of, the people who do their contracts know that they got to find a way to get them done. But sometimes I don't know if there's enough attention at the top necessarily heeded to the cap aspect of things over the long haul. So those are the teams that I would say stand out on the other side a little bit more to me. Garrett asks, where can you get the podcast? But I guess I'll just answer that one on Twitter. Voting Ho. Just in general, how did you get into OTC salary cap stuff? You know, I just like talking about football. You know, obviously I like sports. I like to try and even still play a little basketball here and there, even though I'm pretty out of shape again now. You know, I always liked football, love talking about football. Love numbers. I like working with numbers. And I always thought the salary cap was just a really interesting thing. And really, it just was, you get into talking about stuff on, at the time, message boards, I guess it was, usually about the Jets. And, you know, there's always a lot of salary cap talk because the Jets were usually had some issues. You know, you're getting into the turnover from the Terry Bradway to Mike Tannenbaum regime, and there were some issues there. And so I got into it really into kind of being the I guess the message board expert on the Jets, you know, probably in like 2008-ish, you know, and so I did the Jets salary cap website. And I just really enjoyed it and just was fascinated by it and, you know, like getting to learn about it and trying to track down numbers and understanding the logic behind it and, you know, talking about it in a different way. I didn't want this to be the regurgitation of articles. And we do that from time to time and didn't want it to be the, you know, the just the general, like, okay, let's see if we can we somehow get on that text list when 17 reporters will tweet out the exact same things, which is just a quick copy and a paste from a message that you got from a quote unquote league source, you know, to hopefully be that first one on Twitter. Do we want to be? No. You know, the goal is to understand more, I think, about the salary cap structures of the teams and how they're doing contracts and how you can, you know, kind of optimize deals to benefit players or benefit a team or, you know, just different ways that you can analyze it. And I think it was a very different approach than anyone really ever taken to it. And probably for the most part still does. You know, there's some really good cap people that do for certain teams now. But I've always thought that what we did, certainly from the start, was pretty ambitious and very different than anyone else that had tried to probably do a salary cap website, and certainly on a full league level. Chuck Harris asks, thoughts on the Cardinals free agent signings after trading for Hopkins? All right, let me pull up their list of free agents here. I don't think I was really blown away. I don't think I was necessarily negative too much on them. let's just pull up who they signed. 2020 teams. How can I filter this? I know Nick has a filter here. Arizona. Okay, here we go. All right, so Larry Fitzgerald, we won't even count that. Gilbert at one, that's fine. Kennard at 6-7, that's okay. Phillips is not a good deal. Phillips 10, that's rich. I'm not sure what they see in that one. Humphreys at 14-8 is perfectly fine for left tackle. I know that was right. That was before free agency really kicked in. I kind of get transition tagging Drake. I think they probably could have done a cheaper 3-year deal that would have made more sense for them. It's only 3 years. You probably would have gotten the numbers down to where you would have paid him 10 over 2 instead of 8 for the 1. That to me makes more sense. Campbell, okay signing. I wouldn't call it great. I did say it's okay. It's, you know, you bring a lot of their own guys back, you know, a couple guys from outside the team. They have a salary cap structure they're still kind of working their way out of there. So they're still finding their footing. And I think they're still in a state where they're kind of just kind of finding their way until Murray develops and, you know, they kind of take that next step to really become a playoff contender, I think, before they try and find a way to go a little bit more crazy when it comes to contracts. Let's see. What else do we have here? KC guy, looks like you guys have the cutoff salary for comp picks way higher than last year. Why? Last year, 1-3 would be compensable. Now even 1-7 doesn't seem to make the cut. Nick is the person to ask for that. I'll try and forward that over. He's better at that than I am. But I would say the two reasons mainly for that. Let me just pull up the page. But the main one, first of all, is probably just that the amount of signings has just been over a certain number. But the second thing is probably the fact that I think they have a rule in place now that where, you know, basically if the signing is for less than two, it's not going to count. But the main thing is the big money deals. And I think really the main factor here, I'm just looking at the players who were signed. I think there's two factors here. One, you have a quarterback period in free agency. So you've got three high-priced quarterbacks. Normally you wouldn't have any, or maybe you'd have one. So you have three quarterbacks that fit into the equation. And I think the second thing is that you have a lot of teams right now that are getting compensatory picks. So whereas in the past you had teams that, you know, would lose a player but gain a player, and you'd have a lot of that ping pong kind of effect. This year that doesn't seem to be the case. I don't know if that's because there's so much uncertainty that there's been less signings. You know, I mentioned about how the other day there were so many free agents still out there. I'm not going to say that it's completely out of the norm, but when you're talking about five or six signings that would probably offset some, you know, that's a pretty big deal. But it's probably a combination of having three quarterbacks and maybe teams just being a little bit smarter, you know, with those positions there, with those decisions. Let's see. Next questions. I got to go to the other one. Those are just from this afternoon. Let's see. I know I have a post here. I got to find it. And I hope I didn't lose it. Where the heck did I put it? Let's see. I know I have it. There we go. I had a couple. Not a lot of questions here, so this should be pretty quick. The dude, 1234, asks, when looking at the Rams' moves this offseason, how much credit do you give them for cutting bait when they realized the moves weren't going to work out? Do you think many GMs would make the tough call and admit their mistakes? So, obviously, I covered that before. Do I think many GMs would make the same tough call? Probably 50-50. Probably not on two players unless they went into a full rebuild. So here's the thing. If you are completely blowing things up, Miami Dolphins last season, yeah, they'll make those decisions because you're just saying, you know, you've got all your papers, you're throwing them in the air, and you're saying that's it. You know, so you make those moves and you just get away with it. When I look at most of these teams, no, I don't think most of the teams would do that. I think they would look at the sunk cost aspect of it, and they'd say, hey, we paid this guy a lot of money. We're still going to pay him money. It's going to cost a lot on our cap to get rid of him. Let's just let's keep him this year. And I know our coaching staff can get something out of him. So I'll say 50-50, but, you know, maybe not too much. Corey asks, maybe it's the quarantine brain kicking in, but I'm struggling to follow the math of how the Rams are responsible for $21 million in dead money for Cooks. Okay, so real quick on Cooks here, let's pull him up. So the reason Cooks' number is so high is because the Rams used a lot of signing bonuses in there. So whenever you use bonuses that prorate in a contract, it all kind of sticks on the cap, and when you cut the player, it all accelerates up. So they gave him a $7 million signing bonus that counted for $1.4 million a year from 2018 through 2022, I think. Then there was a $17 million option bonus where the proration began in 2019, and that ends in 2023. So basically what you look at is he had proration in 2020 of $4.8 million. 2021 and 2022 are the same number, and $3.4 million in 2023. 3.4 is just the $17 million number. So you add those three up, and then you add the 3.4 to that as well. And so that's where you get the money that's associated just with the acceleration from the prorated money. They paid him a $4 million roster bonus on the third day of the league year, I think it was. So that sticks with them as well. So you add up all those numbers, you add in the $4 million, and you get to the 21.8. So that's why this is why a lot of teams have tried to move away from the signing bonuses somewhat. If you look at the percentages of some of these older signing bonuses relative to the size of the contract versus where the league is at now, NFL teams have done a much stronger job of minimizing the costs that are associated with the signing bonuses if they have to trade away or release a player. The trades were never really a consideration before. Now they are. in the Rams case, that these were both probably older style deals, where they, these kind of went back, you know, back to the past, where you did have a lot of prorated money in the contracts that made it more difficult to do this. Jason Katz asks, obviously there's a lot of negatives in regards to the salary cap with the Cooks trade. I'd love to hear some numbers about the positives of it cap-wise in the future, how much it frees up and what their cap will look like. Maybe even add in extensions for Cup, Ramsey, and JJ3 here. So, you know, I think that was all stuff that we touched on already, to where they are with their cap. And now they're in a position to where you can extend the players that you need to extend probably without worrying about the salary cap. You know, even if you're talking big contracts for some of those players, you know, you can do that. Like I said, they're up to, you know, in the ballpark of $40 million in effective cap space, give or take a little bit, or 49? Let me see. I'm trying to remember if it was 49 total. No, it was 49 in effective cap space, 58 it looks like total. You know, for where they're at. So, I mean, you've got, you know, a lot of flexibility there. You know, I'm just looking, you know, if they wanted to push money on Donald, I guess they could. You know, there's always a question, you know, is Whitworth going to retire? Is he not going to retire? That opens up cap room if they do that. You know, do you extend Woods? That opens up cap space. Cut Rockers? That opens up cap space. You know, do you cut your right tackle? That's going to open up cap space. You cut the punter, that'll open up a couple of bucks. There's a lot of flexibility that they have. This is going to be the bad year. This is going to be the year that you take the pain, you know, without having to completely rip apart the team, and you know, you're good. John asks, what about the Houston Texans? What about them? You know, I was watching the other day. I was thinking about this. You know, I threw on a video of the Jets draft blunders. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with that video. It's classic. You know, the fans, you know, I have been there. I know the feeling. You know, the pick comes in of Kenny O'Brien, and it's like, well, you know, I wanted Dan Marino, but those Jets, that front office, they know something we don't know. Yeah, obviously not. You know, you've got the Blair Thomases and the Johnny Mitchell and the Kyle Brady with everyone chanting, we want Sapp. And I wish that there would have been a way to get a whole bunch of Texans fans somehow online at once, so we could have made a video of just the moves that the Texans have done in the last 2 years with some of these decisions. I think it'd be classic to get that reaction of, you know, the Texans have paid Jadeveon Clowney $7 million and they're receiving back a three. And you would see everyone throw their papers in the air. And they're trading DeAndre Hopkins and getting back David Johnson and a two. And now they're going to flip that two for Brandon Cooks. You know, and I know it's a different number two that they're trading, but I think it'd be great to get those reactions of the fans throwing their hands in the air, just banging a head against the wall, you know, being all upset about it. It's a bad trade for them. You know, is it affordable for Cooks? Yeah. Okay. So where you get into the value again, you know, on the trades, you know, we're looking at a deal that I think is $47 million over 4 years for them. That's perfectly fine for him, as long as the concussions don't prop up. If he goes back to being, you know, an 800, 900 yard receiver, you know, right around those numbers, that's perfectly fine. They'll be happy with him for 1 or 2 years. There's nothing guaranteed in the future, so it's not like there's anything tying them to him long term. The problem is, what are you building here? You've got Fuller. Now you've got Cooks. You just paid $9 million for Randall Cobb. Like, what offense are they building? You know, that's the part I don't get with them. It's $36 million I think they have invested in, like, the four receivers. Three of them, I don't know if you'll get 40 games out of the Cooks, Fuller, Stills trio. I don't know why you would sign Cobb if there was a thought in your mind that maybe you'd trade for Cooks. You know, if there was a thought that you were going to do this, well, you know what? You should have broached this with them. You know, if the roster bonus was due on the 20th, you should have broached this trade with the Rams on the 21st before you signed Randall Cobb. Trust me, Randall Cobb wasn't going anywhere at $9 million bucks a year. He just wasn't. it's just a wild allocation. They have the most invested now if you combine running backs and wide receivers because they have so much spent on David Johnson. They've added more bodies. I don't see how it makes them better. I don't see how, again, you're saving the Rams $8 million basically by making this trade. That's not a second round pick. You know, in my mind, you know, you should be getting a third or, you know, a third and a five, a three and a five, maybe a four. Yeah, something like that. I don't think you should be giving up a two. Maybe there's some other things coming back to them that I don't know about, but I think it's just an overpayment. And just the way that they've constructed it, you know, where you talk about, you know, are all these people on the same page? And I think it's just very random. It just seems very haphazard. You know, maybe this is something where they're like, well, we couldn't really turn it down. We thought he was too talented. You know, our guys like him. Our guys are familiar with him. And, you know, it's not crazy about it. So I don't think it's good for them. But, hey, whatever. So I think that'll do it for me. So amazingly, the kids did not make an appearance. I'm a little surprised by that. Kind of stunned. So the next podcast that I do, I guess, unless something big pops up, I'll try and offer some CBA thoughts and some of the new things. Again, haven't really dug much into it, but a lot of it seems the same. But just the general overall points that were put out there about kind of the changes that were there, we'll talk about that a little bit. May I look at another team's salary cap moving forward just to see where they are, see some of the more interesting ones that might be out there. And again, send in your questions, send in your thoughts. If I want to try some video or do some other things here and there, you know, that we can post on OTC or try and use Twitter or something along those lines, I can slowly but surely kind of figure my way out. If you get a chance, you know, you can pick up either Crunching Numbers or The Drafting Stage. It was pretty cool. The other day, I put a post up there where the Kindle versions of the books were both in the top 70 of football books. Again, shows you not a lot of people read, but I thought that was pretty neat. I thought that was pretty cool. If you don't follow Brad, you can find him. I think it's at BradOTC. Let me see if there's an underscore in there. I'm sure Brad will be doing all kinds of cool stuff on draft day in a couple weeks. Yep, just at BradOTC. If you haven't followed him before, give him a follow. Give you all kinds of cool salary cap stuff he'll talk about as well. But he's really loves all this draft stuff, and you can ask him any questions that you might have about different tidbits that he picked up while researching the Drafting Stage. And, you know, I think that'd be a good follow. And if you're a Bears fan, you can give him a follow too. You know, he'll give you some good looks on the Bears, hopefully pretty objective. I think that's it for me. And so maybe we'll be back in a couple days. Hope everyone is doing well and staying safe out there. So we will talk to you again sometime soon.